going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. This is National Police Week, and we begin 2 days of looking at policing in communities in the greater D.C. area. Tonight, we take a look at how communities are acting with officers that are protecting and serving. We'll take a look at the good and the bad. And tomorrow, we will hear from the men and the women behind the badge. Tonight, my guests are Lucia Tien. She is Chief Analytics Officer with the ACLU here in D.C. Carlene Ponder. She is an activist, civil rights attorney, and founding member of the Silver Spring Justice Coalition. And Victoria Clark. She is an attorney and president of the Northern Virginia Urban League's Young Professionals Network. You're certainly welcome to give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to thank all of you for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So let me start with you, Ms. Tien. The ACLU released a report yesterday, and it talks about arrests of black people in D.C. It says that a disproportionate number of black people in the District of Columbia have been arrested no matter what the community happens to look like. Can you give me the short version of what this report found? Ms. Tien, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, please.
Okay, fantastic, and thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
The report, in short, is a report that my team worked on in conjunction with the ACLU of DC, and what it is an analysis of arrest data, which is pretty complete from 2013 to 2017, that was obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request. Filed by Open the Government and the ACLU of D.C. With the Metropolitan Police Department. Now, when we started to take a look at the data, the results were pretty striking. There are pretty dramatic racial disparities in police arrests, and that's pretty consistent across arrest types, from the most serious to the most minor, and across geographies. We looked at everything from majority white neighborhoods all the way to majority black neighborhoods. On the whole, black people are arrested at 10 times the rate of white people. And, of course, that ranges all the way up to 29 times in certain neighborhoods. That, I would say, is the broad takeaway.
And it's fascinating, but Ms. Ponder, I would argue that that's not news.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with you that it is not news that black folks are arrested at a much higher proportion than other people, particularly white people, all across this country.
Why?
I think that there are a number of historic reasons for that. We have to look at the way that we have policed black people in this country from the beginning. You have to ask yourself, was policing set up for the protection and the service of black communities?
Mm. One of the things that we have seen just over the past week in Montgomery County, specifically Silver Spring, an incident where a white female police officer was heard on body cam and cell phone cam using the N-word when addressing four young black men. And while they're still a lot of a discussion about how she used it, why she used it, and whether or not she was repeating what these young men were saying. Your thoughts about that as we talk about the whole of interaction with police and young black men, because these guys were reportedly waiting for jobs as they do every day, landscaping jobs and the like.
Yes. And so the Silver Spring Justice Coalition, which is a coalition of activists like myself and organizations and just folks who live in the area and who are fed up with this, held a rally yesterday. And that was actually in front of the police station, in front of the 3rd District Police Station, where the officers came from who were, I would say, harassing the young men. And so what we found out is that the police officers were not called to the scene. So the business, McDonald's, didn't call and say, you know, we've got some concerns about these young men standing outside the business. In fact, the young men had just eaten inside the McDonald's and they were outside waiting for rides to get to work. They had jobs to go to. Apparently, the police have a practice of frequenting this location. One of the things that we are asking for is the release of all the body cam footage. So far, what's been released to the news is the third-party camera that was taken by somebody, an observer on the scene who did the right thing, and then one of the officers' body cam footage. There were about 9 police officers on the scene. We want all of the body cam footage released because, as we understand it, the female officer who used the N-word was one of the later arriving officers on the scene, but there were other officers there before her. We want to know what were they doing? What were they saying as well?
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is part one of a 2-part look at policing in communities in the greater D.C. area. Tonight we're looking at how communities are interacting with officers that are protecting and serving. Tomorrow we will hear from police representatives on this same issue. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Victoria, there was a report released about the Charlottesville Police Department and information about stop and frisk in that community. This report is suggesting that for the second straight month, more African Americans were stopped than white people in that city since that information was first published in September. Are you surprised at this?
I'm not surprised at all. As we know, stop and frisk is inherently racist. There is no if, and, or but about it. We know that stop and frisk is code for let me find someone who looks of color and see what they have going on, because we think that those people are committing some type of crime and we want them off the street. So there's definitely no surprise there.
Ms. Tian, as it relates to this report, one of the things that I think is really fascinating about it, and you kind of, listed some of the numbers before, is that we're talking in some cases 80 to 90% of the arrests that were tabulated are African Americans. Again, no matter what community they happen to live in, even though D.C. is no longer the chocolate city that many of us from this area grew up in.
Yeah, that's right. And, we looked at, one of the easiest critiques are, what I've been following, sort of the responses on social media and so forth to our issuing this report. And, of course, anytime that you, who are in this business, we know this isn't news. But any time that something like this is issued, the response is, of course, that crime is associated with race, and this could be for a variety of reasons, including poverty. So in the report, we went one step further, right, and we dove into arrest categories for which we have a sense that the base rates should definitely look similar, right? So we looked at traffic violations, we looked at low-level marijuana arrests, where there's very good evidence that black and white usage rates for marijuana are very similar. And still, in those categories, you see that huge disparate number. And so that really combined, the fact that the disparity is so large, combined with the fact that it's there no matter how you cut the data, it really starts to illuminate a problem.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about policing in communities in the greater District of Columbia area, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Tonight we are looking at how communities are interacting with officers that are protecting and serving. And, of course, tomorrow we will be talking to representatives of various and sundry police departments. If you have a comment, if you have a question about this discussion tonight, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's talk to Dennis, calling from D.C. Dennis, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about things that's been going on as far as the police and things that they do. It's been going on a long time.
Well, go ahead and make your point quick. We've got a lot of folks on the line, but go right ahead, please.
I'm 59. We used to go out in Georgetown. They had a hamburger place, 25 cents. After dark, if you still there, police used to harass you. I mean, stop you, ask you what you're doing out there. And it's terrible, and it's been going on a long time.
Thank you, Dennis, for sharing that with us. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ty, calling from Virginia. Ty, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, everyone knows in the crowd who's the bad guy. It's no hidden secret. In this case, you had this female officer who was a tenured of 10 years on that job to present day. They know how she felt. In this day and age, I can't believe, and actually I do, that you have a woman who was sworn to uphold the oath, took the oath, that can say that N-word so freely, and then you have other officers, I've seen the videotape, standing around of color and not even saying a word. And so it makes me wonder, what truly do you think of my presence that you could say that so freely and feel that there will be no repercussions from being said? And you must remember, it starts at the top.
Your thoughts about that, Carlene?
Yeah, that's a really great point about all of the other officers who were standing around on the scene and the officers of color. One of the things we're calling for with the Silver Spring Justice Coalition is that the Montgomery County Police Department adopt a duty to intervene, which says that other officers, if they are observing their fellow police officers violating somebody's rights, engaging in some form of misconduct, those officers have a duty to intervene. You have to step up. You have to say something. You have to report that misconduct or violation of civil rights to your supervisor.
Thank you so much for that phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are in the first segment of a 2-day examination of policing in communities in the D.C., in the greater D.C. area. This is National Police Week, and tonight we are talking to activists as well as one of the officials from the ACLU about a new report about policing in the District of Columbia. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We want to hear about your interaction with police, good or bad. And of course, tomorrow we are going to be hearing from representatives with the police department. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. But this conversation continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141 in just a few seconds. We'll be taking more of your phone calls next.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. This is National Police Week, and we begin 2 days of looking at policing in communities in the greater D.C. area. Tonight, we're taking a look at how communities interact with police officers that are protecting and serving. And tomorrow, we will hear from the men and women behind the badge. My guests are Lucia Tien. She is Chief Analytics Officer with the American Civil Liberties Union here in D.C., Carlene Ponder, activist, civil rights attorney, and founding member of the Silver Spring Justice Coalition, and Victoria Clark. She is an attorney and president of the Northern Virginia Urban League's Young Professionals Network. If you have a comment, if you have a question about your interaction with police in the D.C. Metro, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go to the phone lines, I want you all to listen to this snippet of an interview that was done back in October with activist and comedian Dio Hughley. It was with Trevor Noah on The Daily Show, and he was talking about his thoughts about black communities, communities of color, and their interaction with police.
Like, we can't keep having these kinds of things happen and everybody kind of go, that's the way things are. Because we can't pretend to be a society. You can't say in a society that we're all about justice and you're innocent until proven guilty, but an officer can summarily slaughter someone in the streets and no one be about to account for it. Even if we know that they did it. Like, Philando Castile, he didn't break the law. We saw what happened.
Right.
We weren't uncomfortable with it. I tell you what, the most dangerous place for black people to live is in white people's imagination. Like, it's never the guy they see. It's not the black guy. It's the black guy in Chicago. It's the black guy they saw on the news. It's the black guy on the video. Like, I'm scared of the black dude in their imagination.
Victoria, is he right?
I think his argument does have some merit. But to the point he made earlier about us wanting justice, it is important to know that justice is a community effort.
What do you mean by that?
It would be great if we could depend on the system as it is now to find justice for our people. But we know that we can't. So we need to participate in the justice system. I'm not saying that it's the cure-all for all of our issues, but we need more black people to become police officers. We need more black people to serve on the juries so that when police do engage in misconduct and they're taken to trial, that they can be found guilty and brought to justice. We need to be showing up in those processes so we can get the justice that we deserve.
What do you think about this?
Well, there's a current lawsuit in Prince George's County right now, Hispanic police officers who are suing the PG County Police Department because they were sick and tired of watching black and Latino folks being abused by their fellow officers. And I understand that when they tried to report the incidents that they were shut down or they found that they, they were not welcomed as one of the team once they began to speak up.
Ms. Chien, as it relates to this report, was there any discussion as to why these high percentages of arrests of people of color was happening?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. And I think, unfortunately, while the data gives an indication that the disparities are large, what we have is certainly not complete data. And so it doesn't really include other information that would help us get at the why or dig to the bottom of the why of why racial disparities exist. And so we hope to continue to push towards more data on things like what happened after the point of arrest, whether or not those arrests were prosecuted, how these arrests came to be, right? 911 call data or complaint information or more complete data on stops. All of that would allow us to disentangle, for example, you know, when you look at the traffic violation case, is it that the disparity is large? Is it that black people are being stopped at higher rates while driving, which, you know, the police officer can't really tell when when they're just stopping someone, whether they're driving without a permit, right? Or whether they're then being arrested at higher rates after they're stopped. The data doesn't tell us that. And so we, the ACLU, are certainly working towards more increased transparency to help answer exactly those types of questions.
One of the things that I find really interesting, and I think we need to put a really fine point on this report, is that you are talking specifically about arrests. We're not talking about stops, conversations, right, interactions. We are talking about recorded arrests. And that the lion's share of these things are, one could argue, quality of life crimes, or I won't even call them crimes, offenses, marijuana, gambling, and the like. Your thoughts about that? Is there a difference between the arrests, recorded arrests, for these, some would argue, minor offenses and other interactions with police?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the really important points that we make in the report as well, is I think it really calls into question how do we spend our policing resources, right? So so the Metropolitan Police Department, as part of the current budget vote, is asking for an increase in their budget. And I think that it's important to analyze in the context of a budget, how are we spending our police efforts? Are we spending police efforts on low-level offenses, activities that are effectively criminalizing poverty, and which are also things that contribute to such a large racial disparity in outcomes?
Interesting.
And I think with those types of analyses in mind, police departments can think about whether there are more efficient and effective ways to deploy their officers and resources.
And I think that's a great point in terms of being efficient with the money that we're spending with our police departments, because that is taxpayer money. I mean, one of the things that we have to consider is the number of encounters, deadly encounters, with persons with mental disabilities who come in contact with police officers. Maybe we should be spending that money on mental health research resources and social workers, and, you know, sending out trained mental health professionals to deal with calls where somebody is known to be agitated because they're suffering with a mental illness. Why send a police officer with a gun? I mean, how many stories do we need to hear about a fatal encounter between a police officer and somebody suffering, you know, with a mental illness?
And so why do we not do that? Because the easiest and most effective way to oppress a group of people is to make them scared to walk out of their house and live their lives in public, just walk down the sidewalk, hang out with their friends. And we know that once you put someone in the system, arrest them, build up enough of a record, then you can start taking some of their civil liberties and other resources away from them. So you might get arrested and released with no charges one time. Okay, well, the next time you get arrested, you have this history now. Let's continue with the charges and prosecute you. Then it's, you're in another state. We're going to see what your history is there. And maybe not in D.C., but in surrounding areas like Maryland and Virginia, and certainly farther you go south, the more you get arrested, the more likely your liberties will be taken away. Your ability to find adequate housing, your ability to have custody of your children, your ability to get an education. All of these things are going to be taken away from you.
So let me ask you this, and this is specifically as it relates to D.C., because this report covered 2013 through 2017. Well, since that time, we have seen the decriminalization of marijuana, for example. And yet this report talks about smoking marijuana in public as just one issue. And I don't want to have a conversation about marijuana per se, but I do want to know if that one particular issue, the decriminalization of marijuana as it stands now, where you can do it in the house, and now the mayor is proposing, the taxing of recreational marijuana, could we see a reduction in these kinds of figures if for example, DC moves forward with something like that, where they don't pay as much attention to those issues that historically have put young black men in jail. Could it work? Go ahead, please.
Yes, I really hope so. I think one of the things that the reason that we looked at marijuana in particular is both because we know that the base rates of usage are relatively similar across black and white people. And so it's a good thing to look at when you're looking for disparities. And also because of this change, this decriminalization that happened in early 2015, I think what we've seen, at least in the data so far, is no evidence that sort of racial disparity is going away because of that. And I think it has to do with both how the decriminalization is happening. So, for example, possession has been legalized under a certain amount, but public consumption is not. And so disproportionately poor people who might not have the private property or be able to use marijuana in the privacy of their own homes are being then targeted for this kind of arrest. And so I think it has to do with both how you do the decriminalization and also in sort of the reaction to it.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Philip, calling from Fort Washington. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you. You know, in the 59 years that I have lived, I have seen where the justification of the shootings with policemen and young black men, it's called killings. What we're seeing today, it's not a killing. It's murder. We talk and talk and talk about this. I say in a nonviolent way, but where do we end talking and what are we going to do about it? When these things happen in our community that has been happening for years, all we do is sit down and we talk about it. We have no solutions to it, and it continues to happen over and over. The news is full of Trump and what's going on in the administration at the same time that there are many black people who are being killed, young black men handcuffed at the age of 10 years old. These things are going on. We don't see it. And then months or a year or two later, we're told about it, but we forget.
Well, let me see what Carlene has to say about this, because there was a march yesterday. You may have some people who say, okay, when are we going to stop marching and start attempting to address this issue with the powers that be? What's your response to that?
Well, one of the things that the Silver Spring Justice Coalition calls for is the end of police investigating police. We have to have accountability. I mean, we're not going to see an end to the shootings until police officers are held accountable, meaning they go to jail when they murder somebody. That does not happen very often at all. So when you allow them to investigate themselves with their internal affairs investigations, and then they come out, they take a year or however long they take, and then they come out and say, oh, we found no wrongdoing. The officer acted within protocol. We're not going to, do any kind of discipline in this situation. Well, how many times do we need to allow that to go on until we say this system is broken? They cannot be allowed to investigate themselves. We have to tear that system down, redo it, put something in place where you have actual members of the affected communities as part of that investigation. You've got to have civil rights attorneys. You've got to have public defenders. You've got to have folks from outside agencies, maybe the state attorney general's agency, involved with those investigations. They can't just be the police department.
Your thoughts about that, Victoria?
I completely agree. And what I want is for us to make sure we stay engaged in these conversations. Everyone has something to say when a video comes out, and this young man was right that we get mad about it and something happens again, but we need to carry on the conversation. We need to keep demanding accountability, and we need everyone to get involved. Everyone certainly has a role to play. We as attorneys play one role, but every member of the community can do something, and we encourage you to join an organization, join a coalition, and get involved in the movement.
And I know we are talking about the DMV, but one of the things that also has been in the news quite recently is the Eric Garner case in New York. In that there was, even though Officer Daniel Pantaleo was not eligible for criminal prosecution, but the participation of a citizens review is now in process. What you are talking about. And it's been years since the death of Eric Garner, but through the judicial system, that Citizens Review has been allowed to keep its ear to the ground in cases like that. From your perspective, Victoria, how can communities of color continue to put the pressure on the powers that be to make sure that they have a voice?
Well, we can continue to show up. Show up at their offices, write your letters, call the news, engage in any type of informational campaign about what's going on. Certainly, we see more people interested in police brutality issues once we started having these cell phone videos come up. Before, it was he said, she said, like we saw with Mike Brown, for example. But now when we have these videos, people are forced to pay more attention.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Adam's calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, how you doing, sir?
Doing just fine.
I heard one of the guests say that we need more black officers, but being from the PG County and also D.C., born in Northeast and raised in Oxon Hill, I beg to differ. Like, I have been beat up and harassed, put in handcuffs in third grade at career day because the cop didn't like my attitude. And all these were black cops. So I don't think the issue is just a racial one. I think it's just a cultural policing one. Like, we need to revamp the whole way we hire and recruit police officers, because like I just mentioned, like, being from this area, a lot of officers are black, and I've been harassed and literally beaten at 16 years old. And I'm not saying I was a perfect youth, but no 16-year-old should be beat up by cops, females, black and male, female cops. Like, so I don't think it's just a racial thing. It's just a straight up policing thing. I know there are good cops out there. My cousin is one of them. I love him with all my heart. You know what I mean? Whenever I'm in an issue, he's the first person I call. If I get pulled over, I'm calling him because I can trust him because he's my loved one. But then I have to ask myself, does he treat other people differently in the street that is not his family? I think it's beyond race, man. It's a straight up policing one. Cops should have to be vetted for way more than 6 to 9 months. It should be way more intense process. That's all I wanted to add.
That's interesting that you do talk about culture. Ms. Tian, what do you think about that? I think that's a very profound statement, that this has more to do with police culture as opposed to race.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have, I fully, you know, I agree with the fact that, you know, that might be one of the root causes as well. I think, it's, what we focus on in the report is really, no matter how you look at it, the outcomes are, certainly impacting communities of people of color more so than others. And so I think that is something that we have to address regardless of the root cause. But I think the root cause is certainly worth digging into.
Victoria?
I think he definitely has a point. Certainly we know that all skin folk ain't kinfolk, mm-hmm. right? And that seems to be even more pronounced once our supposed kinfolk join the police force. But it's about culture as well. So you want your police officers to come.
Which culture? Police culture or skin culture?
So we want our police officers in our community to be of our culture, to be from our community and know who we are, right? So you could say there was a case a few years ago where the defendant said, "That's not my lawyer, dog." And so they said, "Oh, there's no such thing as a lawyer, dog. So he didn't ask for a lawyer. Well, you know, he actually did, because that is one of the black colloquialisms, right? And so we want people to know and recognize that we are not a threat, to understand what we're saying, what we're doing, how we look and why we look that way, and who just grew up with us, who can recognize a friendly face. Certainly, we hear a lot about the kind of mythical big black man that makes certain people of other races scared, right? But if you know who that man is, you're not likely to be as scared. And so that's why we want the police officers to come from our communities. But we need to pair that, as the young man said, with a culture of policing that is based on accountability and actually protecting and serving the community. And certainly we won't get police officers protecting and serving the community when, as in Montgomery County, they're going around calling young men the N-word.
So you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, so you are talking about in the recruiting and hiring of police officers, they need to be culturally competent, no matter what their race happens to be, and to be aware, particularly in this area, Montgomery County being extremely diverse, arguably one of the most diverse municipalities in the entire D.C. region, understanding the nuances of the communities that they are protecting and serving.
So the Silver Spring Justice Coalition came into formation last year after an unarmed black mentally ill man was shot and killed walking in his neighborhood. There was a police officer who came on the scene and thought he was not called as well. He was on the scene for another reason. And he thought the man looked suspicious and tried to stop him rather aggressively. That officer happened to be Indian American, so it was not, you know, a white American police officer. And he recognized that Robert White, the man who was killed, was in some form of mental distress, but things went terribly wrong. There was no, you know, mental health protocol. The crisis intervention team was never called to the scene. The officer ended up shooting Robert White to death, and that's why the coalition formed. But that raises several of the points that just came up. Community policing. This officer should have known Robert White lived in that neighborhood. He should have known that he went out every day for a walk. His neighbors knew him. His neighbors were not afraid of him. This was clearly an officer who was not engaged in community policing. Do we have true community policing anymore?
That's an excellent question. And one that, and that I promise I will be asking the officers and the representatives that we will be discussing in part two of this conversation on tomorrow. Ms. Tien, what is the thing that surprised you the most about the research and the findings in this report?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, I can't say that too much surprised me, as we discussed earlier in this segment. I think this bears out a pattern that is pretty prevalent across the country, not just in the D.C. metro area. I would say, you know, places where we were looking for signs of sort of positive news were in the lower offense categories and on marijuana, and I think, unfortunately, the data just doesn't bear that out.
What do you mean by that?
I think one would hope that after the decriminalization of certain types of marijuana crimes, that at least in those categories, arrests would have dropped, or at least, you know, officers could use citations instead of arrests in those cases. And unfortunately, I think the data doesn't reflect that.
And thank you for using the term citation, because I think that's the word that I was searching for earlier. Arrests versus stops or, a civil citation, a warning, even. But again, this report deals specifically with with arrests. I wanted to ask you, Victoria, in your capacity with the Young Professionals Network, with the Northern Virginia Urban League, when you have discussions about policing, what are the issues that seem to continually come up? Are they the same as we are seeing in the busier parts of this community, in D.C., in Montgomery County, in Prince George's and the like?
Oh, certainly there's the same issues. And I think the number one issue I hear from members of the community is fear. They're scared for themselves. They're scared for their sons. You can't educate yourself out of police brutality. You can't earn yourself out of police brutality. You can't do anything to stop being a target of the police if you are a black person. And I think that reality, when that sets in for people, that can be very scary for them.
So what's the plan from your constituency in attempting to deal with that fear?
I think the plan is to talk more about it. Certainly, the more we talk about knowing your rights, knowing how to interact with the police, knowing what to tell the police, having an attorney that your family can call if some issue happens, those certainly won't safeguard you against any of those issues. But we can help you get some relief in case you are targeted by the police.
Carlene, do you believe that the Montgomery County Police Department is listening to activists such as yourself?
They were not listening before the activists came up upon the scene and became as loud, you know, as we have been over the past year. And I can say that because we had a member of the Montgomery County Council Public Safety Committee say that he doesn't believe that there is a culture problem within our police department. Outgoing police chief, Thomas Manger, and, you know, we're looking for his replacement now, certainly didn't believe that the extent of the problem is what it is, you know, what we have said it is. You know, yesterday at our press conference and rally, we had young men and women come and give individual accounts of being stopped and harassed and even arrested in some cases and held overnight in jail for, you know, minor traffic violations within Montgomery County. There is a problem. The county executive is going to hold a community forum on June 6th in the selection, you know, talk about the selection of the community's next police chief. But I believe that he's holding that forum because of the activism that we've been doing over the past year. We've made our voices loud. You know, we've said we have a problem. We want to be heard. This needs to be dealt with out in the open. And so if we're going to hire a new police chief for this community, we need to make sure that that's somebody who reflects the values that we want to see in our police department.
Final thoughts from you, Ms. Tien, about this report?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have within the report a couple of recommendations for a path forward. And those include, for example, looking at repealing criminal statutes that disproportionately target people in poverty, and also, you know, that clearly cuts across racial lines. I would say in the context of transparency and actually being able to get a finer understanding of what's going on, we demand that the MPD fully implement the NEAR Act, which is an act that requires certain kinds of police reporting, and for that to be shared with the public, as well as a few others. So I think I encourage folks who are interested to take a look and look at some of the practical tactics we can take on in the short term.
Real quick, Carlene, some final thoughts from you.
Yes, I mean, it's unfortunate that communities have to come together, you know, in the wake of another black person being killed by the police. But we have to continue to do this work as long as the injustice is there, as long as we can look up and see, you know, another pregnant black woman being shot and killed by a police officer in this country. We have got to band together, and we have got to demand that the system as it is be taken apart, and we've got to put something entirely new in place where police officers are held accountable for their actions.
And And real quick, you're talking about that the incident that happened outside of Houston. The latest reporting is that she was not pregnant, which does not certainly minimize the death. That investigation still going on. The name of the officer has not been released. The police department in Baytown says they are legally obligated to release the officer's name after 3 days. So we're going to continue to follow that real quick. Victoria, your thoughts?
I just encourage everyone to keep demanding justice, keep demanding accountability from your local police officers, and know that you have rights, and always consult with someone if you feel that your rights have been infringed upon, because there are people out here who can help you.
Thank you so much, Lucia Tian, Carlene Ponder, and Victoria Clark. Thank you all for participating in this conversation. And as I said, we're going to be talking to representatives from various police departments on tomorrow in part two of this conversation. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, May 14th. I'm Harold Fisher. Stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.